SEPTA commuters relying on bus, trolley, and subway lines are coming up with a plan B. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As a strike deadline looms, let's get the latest with WHYY's Jim Saxa. Jim, where do we stand at this hour?
SEPTA negotiators and negotiators from the Transport Workers Union 234 have been meeting over the weekend. They met again starting today at 9:30, and we still haven't come to a compromise. If they don't have a deal by midnight tonight, the union is going to go on strike.
There are substantial financial issues and also peripheral ones. By what means are they trying to come to a court?
The union wants an increase to their pension benefits. They want the pension calculations to match what the management has already. The union has a cap on their pension benefits. SEPTA, on the other hand, they want to increase the amount that the union workers contribute to their health care coverage. Currently, they spend 1% of their salaries, which works out to about $46 per month on average. They are really not seeing eye to eye on either of those. Meanwhile, there are also a number of non-economic issues that the union has been pressing for, such as longer bathroom breaks. They currently only get 5 minutes if you're a bus operator or a trolley operator. And they also want to change some of the work rules so that there's longer downtime between shifts.
Is it your sense that if there is movement in the hours to come, that that midnight deadline could be negotiated back?
No, that deadline is a hard deadline. The union voted 2 weeks ago to authorize a strike. And with that authorization, they basically said, no extensions, we're striking at midnight, and we're staying off the job until we have a new labor agreement.
Is there precedent? When was the last strike?
There is precedent. If you were around in 2009, you remembered that the transit union also struck then for 6 days. What we can expect is that regional rail will be crowded. All of the city's buses, trolleys, and subways are going to stop. Suburban services will remain open for the time being. But you can expect on regional rail, for instance, really, really crowded cars throughout the strike. You should also expect the roads to just be gridlocked throughout Philadelphia and bleeding out into the suburbs.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
WHYY's Jim Saxa on NewsWorks Tonight. Children's health advocates, clergy, and lawmakers gathered in Philadelphia today to talk about the lead paint problems that are making city kids sick. They're reacting to reports in the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philadelphia Daily News showing the city is not fining landlords who fail to contain flaking lead paint in rental units. From WHYY's health desk, Tanya English reports.
Last year, about 2,700 Philadelphia children had a blood test that showed a harmful level of lead. While health concerns in Flint, Michigan were linked to unsafe pipes, in Philadelphia, flaking lead paint in older homes is the problem that most often causes lead poisoning. A 2012 law demands Philadelphia landlords certify units are lead safe if they're rented to families with small children. But city officials confirm what was first reported by the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. No landlords have been fined under that law. Reverend Mark Tyler is senior pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church. He says the city must proactively protect children.
If you don't take care of the lead in the house, we should take the income. And if you want the money back, the rental income back, you've got to fix the problem. And if you don't fix the problem, they should then move towards seizing the property and selling it.
Attorney George Gould with Community Legal Services says the 2012 law could have made a big difference with follow-up.
The problem is a lot of landlords are not doing it.
He says he's been fighting for 40 years to get building owners to clean up their properties.
The sad part is much of this happens in poverty areas, minority areas in the city.
Lead poisoning can cause brain damage in very young children and delays in speech and hearing. Philadelphia officials say slashed federal funding and too few inspectors have made it hard to identify and pursue landlords. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Before returning home this evening to take inventory of Halloween treats, gaze overhead to see if the moon is playing a trick. Joining me is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this sounds like a scary assignment.
Well, the good thing about this being this kind of assignment is that you don't really have to do very much. Today, the moon is one day old. Now, that's not the best for Halloween. You know, typically on Halloween, you'd like to have maybe a full moon because that looks the scariest, and it's the perfect moon for the witch flying in front of the moon, and you see the silhouette. Well, that's not going to happen tonight because the moon is one day old. So what that actually means is that the moon sets almost immediately after sunset, okay? But the other thing is that tonight, the moon is at its farthest distance from the Earth for the entire year.
Oh, it's very small then.
Well, you would think it would be very small, but if you actually try to measure the difference, it's almost negligible. You can't really see it, and if you wanted to be able to measure it, you'd have to have the moon either in some sort of a measurement device and making those measurements steadily from day to day to day. Or the other thing is you'd have to have some object that was close enough to the moon that you could use it for comparison measurement. Now, the same is true for what I'm now dubbing the mini moon. This mini moon, when the moon is furthest at its furthest distance from Earth, and it apparently should be its smallest. But my point is that there's a very special optical illusion, a trick that our brain plays on us when we see the full moon close to the horizon, near objects of known size. The moon appears to be really, really big, and we can see it in photographs, you can see it with the naked eye, all those sorts of things. And as the moon then rises up to its highest point in the night sky, it may look smaller. Well, the moon at the horizon and at that high point, the zenith point, is actually the same size. But the optical illusion of having it near objects of known size when it's close to the horizon makes us see it, makes our brain see it as being that much larger. If we were to actually measure it at the horizon and then measure overhead, either at supermoon or mini moon, we'd find that the moon will appear to be the same angular size.
So let's park Halloween. Now give us some context for the holidays ahead.
Well, actually, tomorrow is another holiday, and that holiday is All Saints Day. So if you think about Halloween as being that one night during the entire year when ghosts and goblins and evil spirits and all sorts of other evil incantations are running about, well, we need a counter to that so that we can get all of those ghosts and goblins and evil incantations to go back to where they came from. And so that happens the very next day, November 1st, All Saints Day, only to be followed the very next day by a follow-up to All Saints Day as All Souls Day.
Wednesday.
So I think we need two of these, All Saints and All Souls, to push all the evil things back into the wherever they came from for Halloween, and I think maybe also to sell our stomachs after all the candy we've eaten from Halloween.
And then Sunday, we're pushing the clocks back.
Yes, indeed. We are pushing the clocks back. And indeed, we're right at that time of year that's smack halfway between the first day of fall, the first day of winter. So Halloween marks that cross-quarter day. And immediately following that, we move our clocks back 1 hour. So this Sunday coming up, 2 a.m., we'll push our clocks back to 1, and we'll be back on standard time again. Now, all of this is a process that's driving us right toward the winter solstice. And as I've mentioned several times before, what I love about this is we're really getting all of that dark time out of the way so that as we get to the solstice, we're actually working our way back towards spring.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Apart from the presidential race, the marquee contest in Pennsylvania this year is the battle for a U.S. Senate seat. Whichever party wins will help determine control of the Senate in January. WHYY's Dave Davies has this look at incumbent Republican Pat Toomey, a man with deeply held conservative values who's struggling to hold on to the seat he captured 6 years ago.
I didn't meet this gentleman. You are?
I'm Jay Sean Colbert.
Jay, very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Pat Toomey, what grade are you in?
Eighth.
You're in eighth. How long have you been at this school?
All my life.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Pat Toomey recently spent a Thursday morning touring the Belmont Charter School in West Philadelphia. He's not the kind of politician who lights up a classroom, or any room, really. Harrisburg veteran David Patty says Toomey is quietly effective and doesn't try to be something he isn't.
You know, he grew up in New England, and he has that Yankee New England reserve. He is not the glad-handing, back-slapping person.
Toomey grew up in East Providence, Rhode Island, the son of a union dad who laid cable for the electric company. He has five brothers and sisters, went to public and parochial school, then Harvard. After college, he went into finance, first for Chemical Bank, then a Wall Street firm where he worked in derivatives. Not a popular thing after the 2008 crash. He did well, spent a year in Hong Kong, became a pilot, and owned a plane. But he eventually grew tired of New York and set a new course. He and two brothers decided to get into the restaurant business in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
And Pat actually lived just down the street from my parents. He lived about a block from my parents.
That's Charlie Dent, who succeeded Toomey in Congress. Toomey, who'd held deeply conservative views since college, got to know local Republicans. He served on a city charter review commission. Then, when a seat opened in Congress, came from behind in a crowded field and went to Washington. Alan Jennings remembers those years. For decades, he's headed the Allentown Community Action Committee, which runs a food bank, does small business development, weatherizes homes, and provides other services. He says when the Bush administration planned to eliminate funding for the committee and similar groups, he mobilized opposition and asked Toomey to help.
Besides having the people we serve sending letters, we had some of the congressman's strongest supporters, bank presidents, and early supporters of Pat Toomey when he was running for the first time. And none of that mattered.
What mattered, Jennings says, was Toomey's ideological commitment to limited government and spending cuts. Toomey promised to limit himself to just three terms, and he did. In 2004, he left his congressional seat and aimed higher, challenging the state's senior senator, Arlen Specter, in the Republican primary. Toomey had long proven himself to be serious, hardworking, and disciplined. This campaign showed something else. He can be tough.
I just represent the Republican wing of the Republican Party, and Arlen Specter represents a set of liberal views that are just outside of the mainstream. You're also going to see that Senator Specter has a bit of a pattern of doing what I call the Specter two-step. This is a habit of voting with liberals and Democrats for usually the first 5 years, and then approaching a Republican primary, throwing a few votes to the conservatives.
Though Specter had a huge edge in name recognition and the active support of establishment Republicans, including President George W. Bush, Toomey came within 2 points of unseating him. The race and the rightward drift of the Republican base effectively drove Specter out of the party, paving the way for Toomey's election to the Senate in 2010. In between the two runs, Toomey found a home running the conservative business-backed group The Club for Growth. He pushed an aggressively free-market, limited government agenda. He's remembered for this comment on CNBC in 2007 on reducing corporate tax burdens.
It's better for our workers. It's better for our economy. It would attract more capital. I think the solution is to eliminate corporate taxes altogether.
In the Senate, Toomey tacked toward the center on gun control after the Sandy Hook killings, joining West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin to try and expand background checks. The effort failed, but it was a political bonanza for Toomey. In his re-election bid, he has the support of the daughter of the principal killed at Sandy Hook. She did a commercial for him. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords is with him, and the PAC of Michael Bloomberg has spent $3 million to support his campaign. He's also supported some efforts to help Pennsylvania communities, even when they involved government spending, such as dredging the Delaware River so it can welcome larger ships and expand local port business. Congressman Dent thinks Toomey has evolved in office. Toomey says, not really.
I've always looked for a sensible solution, a place that makes progress for Pennsylvania in keeping with conservative principles. Not sure that there's really been that much change, but I'm proud of the record that I have.
These days, Toomey emphasizes his collaboration with Democrats and presents himself as an independent who will break with his party when it's the right thing to do. But he remains one of the most conservative members of Congress, and his views on a host of issues, from abortion rights to tax policy to health care, differ sharply from his Democratic challenger, Katie McGinty. He's dodged the question of whether he'll support his party's presidential nominee, Donald Trump, and McGinty has attacked him regularly for not declaring his allegiance. But Toomey maintains voters care more about how he stands on the issues than whether he casts a ballot for Trump. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Halloween costumes tend to follow pop culture trends from year to year, but some characters stand the test of time. Zombies, vampires, and werewolves are established icons of the holiday. Dr. Greg McDonald, head of forensic medicine at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, contends that these fictional frights may have actually been inspired by real-life medical conditions. Dr. McDonald, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, the holiday has forever been associated with the dead and the undead. What sparked your initial interest in this topic?
Well, I always was a fan of horror movies when I grew up, zombie movies, vampire movies. And then as I got into medicine, I saw that there are some legitimate medical problems that probably have contributed to the rise of these legends, vampires, zombies, what have you.
So cite an example that comes to mind.
Well, for vampirism, actually, it has a close link to rabies. Rabies is a virus that attacks the central nervous system, and it's transmitted by animals. And one of the animals happens to be a bat. And bites to the neck tend to be more severe in rabies. And people who contract rabies oftentimes have symptoms similar to a vampire. They have insomnia. They tend to have very aggressive, erratic behavior. And it's also been noted that they tend to be hypersexual, that you see a lot of vampire movies where Dracula comes into a woman's bedchamber and bites her. But sometimes the virus attacks that part of the brain responsible for sex drive. And many times vampirism has been associated with something called porphyria, which is a metabolic disorder and people lack an enzyme. And that enzyme doesn't break down this porphyrin, which is a component of blood. So it builds up in the body, and it can affect the central nervous system and the skin. One of the problems they have is they can't go out in the sun. They tend to blister. They tend to scar from the sun. They tend to have red-stained urine. And so if someone behaves that way, you may think, again, that they have suffered from bite of a vampire.
When these customs first came about, was it the intended effect to mimic the symptomology, or it just came along parallel to observing, for example, these symptoms?
I think it paralleled it. I think, you know, if you're a Transylvanian peasant and someone gets bit by a bat or something like that, then they start acting strangely, you may start to build that into legend because you don't understand the medicine behind it.
Sticking with the animal kingdom, but expanding beyond Homo sapien, you mentioned bats. Of course, the werewolf is often a popular iteration as well.
Yes, absolutely. And some aspects of the things I've spoken about, rabies and porphyria, may be attributable to lycanthropy or the werewolf disease as well. Porphyria has been associated with an increased hair growth as well. And again, the behavior that they may exhibit probably at times were attributed to so-called werewolves.
Let's next take up, for example, Frankenstein, and not the Mel Brooks young Frankenstein version.
Right. Well, Frankenstein, or having someone reanimate from the dead, probably does have some basis in postmortem changes in the body. So when a person dies, especially before we had embalming, the body's going to decompose, and it's going to bloat up with gases. Oftentimes, there will be what we call purge fluid coming from the nose and mouth from decomposition, and that may be blood-stained. So if you have a body that's been buried and it hasn't been embalmed, and you know something goes wrong and you happen to unearth that body is going to be bloated. It's going to look like they're feeding on flesh or blood. There may be blood coming from the nose and mouth. And so, again, your peasant's going to think that person may have arisen from the dead, was feeding on blood or feeding around someone in the village, and then went back into their grave.
How do you contrast this rising or motion with what's commonly thought of as rigor mortis post-death?
Well, that's very good. Rigor mortis, or rigor mortis as it's called, is a stiffening of muscles after death. But it doesn't last forever. As the body decomposes, the muscles begin to break down, and rigor mortis, or the stiffness, resolves. So by about 36 hours or so, the body will become flaccid once again, and then it starts to decompose and then it starts to become puffy.
Doctor, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Greg McDonald, head of the Forensic Medicine Program at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Trick or treat.
Trick or treat.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.